From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why is it suddenly more difficult for artists from other countries to come perform in the United States? Then, for his documentary American Chaos, director Jim Stern left his liberal bubble in Los Angeles and talked to early supporters of Donald Trump in the months leading up to the 2016 presidential election.
I felt, wouldn't it be interesting if you were able to speak to people who were at the beginning of a movement before people had caught up to them?
And fashion photography moves from glossy magazines to Instagram. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. There are a lot of great artists around the world, and many of them, singers, painters, dancers, visit the United States on a regular basis to perform. But the United States is clamping down on who can come into the country, and earlier this week, the Department of Homeland Security gave its staff more authority to reject visa applications. Now, advocates for traveling artists fear that cultural visas will be harder to get. Matthew Covey is the founding director of Thomas Dot. It's a nonprofit that promotes international artistic exchange.
The U.S., both culturally and politically, really thrives when there are robust connections and healthy connections between our culture and other cultures. And the arts is one of the main ways those connections are maintained. And the purpose of Thomas Dot and the reason we got into this work was really to try to make sure that the U.S. remains culturally connected with the rest of the world, that we can continue to learn from the experiences of others.
There's an argument that's made in the broader economy, which is buy American, hire American, that work visas should be awarded only to the most highly skilled and highest paid foreign workers to fill jobs that can't be filled by an American. Do you hear that argument in the arts world as well?
I hear it, but I don't think you hear it very much in the arts, because the P&O visas, which is what most artists use to come to the U.S., are really unique and are separate from the framework of employment visas to the U.S. I'll give you an example. If you're Deutsche Bank and you want to bring an executive from your Frankfurt office to work in your Chicago office, you have to prove to the satisfaction of the U.S. Labor Department that that individual has something that is really unique that no U.S. worker can supply. Whereas if you're doing a music festival and you want to book U2 to play at your music festival, you can't just use Dave Matthews instead. So the P&O visas were created by Congress to address the notion that artists are who they are. They're not interchangeable in the way that most workers are.
And I understand there's a new policy that affects people who are trying to come in, and it allows the U.S. government to deny visas or green card applications due to a couple factors, including lack of evidence or typos. What is this new policy, and what is it going to mean to artists?
That's a really good question. And the policy just went into effect on September 11th. Affecting applications and petitions that are submitted after the 11th. So we don't really know in practice how it's going to work. U.S. Homeland Security has said that they may be denying petitions that have no substantial legitimate value. If that's the case, then that's kind of understandable, and it may not actually affect the majority of the work that's being done to help artists getting into the U.S. The thing that I think has a lot of people scared is that with this change, there is a lot of potential for misuse, and that misuse could really put artists at risk if we're seeing requests for evidence no longer happening and denials happening in situations when a legitimate petition has been filed.
If the reasons for an artist not being able to come to the country aren't always transparent and the appeal process is either complicated or takes a long time, what are the remedies? What can you do for somebody in my situation?
This is something that comes up an awful lot with artists coming, for example, from Africa, where the petition will be approved. So they've got a work authorization, but they go into the embassy and say, yeah, I'm going to be going to the U.S. to do some shows. And their visa application is denied because the embassy doesn't believe that they have reason to return to their home in Africa. we can come in and say, well, you need to apply again, and you need to go in with documentation showing that you have a spouse and you own a business and you own your house. And all of these kinds of factors can help show the embassy that, no, you're not a flight risk. They're not going to emigrate illegally to the U.S. They're going to come, they're going to do their show, and then they're going to return home.
A couple of months ago, the Supreme Court upheld the United States' so-called Muslim ban, which prevents people from certain countries from entering the United States. When you look at the kinds of artists who aren't able to come into the United States, are there certain regions of the world where artists have a more difficult time coming from into the United States?
Absolutely. When the travel ban was announced, we followed up with an announcement saying that if there were any artists who were affected by the ban, that we would take those cases on pro bono. That has led to some really interesting projects that we have been working on, because the travel ban does provide for the possibility of a waiver if you can show that a waiver is in the national interest. Unfortunately, it doesn't define what the national interest is. So we've spent a lot of time in the last year developing different strategies for exploring how do you show the U.S. government that something is in the national interest. We were very excited last January when we obtained what we believe was the first waiver of the travel ban, and that was for a Syrian dancer who was commissioned to perform in Cincinnati. It created both a model that other arts organizations could use, but it also kind of gave a sense of hope to a lot of us in the art world, thinking that, you know, there may be a way to work with this.
It's one thing if a classical guitarist from Spain wants to come into the United States, but it seems like it would be much more complicated if, say, there's a Middle Eastern dance troupe and their members might come from different countries, and that you have to clear each artist individually. Is that a factor as well, especially with troupes of performing artists?
It's possible to file a petition for an ensemble. If you're bringing a dance company or a musical ensemble, those people are approved or denied on the credentials of the ensemble. If I'm bringing, for example, a dance company from Paris, and three of the members are French nationals, and one member is a Danish national, and another one has a Syrian passport, well, three of those members are fine. We're, you know, once I prove that the dance group is important, then three of them are going to be fine. And then we just have to address the question of whether the travel ban affects the Syrian.
Matthew Covey is the founding director of Thomas Dot. It's a nonprofit that promotes international cultural exchange. Matthew, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, filmmaker Jim Sturton couldn't figure out why voters were flocking to Donald Trump, so he hit the road ahead of the election and made the documentary American Chaos.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In the months leading up to the 2016 presidential election, movie producer Jim Sturton had a sense that Donald Trump was really onto something. As a documentary filmmaker and an avowed Democrat, he decided to leave L.A. to try to capture what he couldn't understand and express. And that was why so many people were so passionate about their support for then-candidate Trump. He interviewed Trump supporters from all over the country, Florida, West Virginia, Arizona, about how and why the real estate developer had won their support. The result is Stern's new documentary titled American Chaos. Stern previously made another political documentary. It was called So Goes the Nation, and it was a look at the 2004 election and the role that Ohio played in George W. Bush's win. But Stern says his experience making American Chaos was something very different.
I felt the echo chamber that I was living in, which was the big cities, was missing the stridency and the fervor of his supporters. And the people that I knew were all rooting for him to get the nomination because they thought that he was going to be the person that Hillary could beat. And when I was watching these rallies, I thought, throughout history, passion has beaten pragmatism. And I was seeing such passion and not on the other side. Plus, only once in our lifetime has a candidate, has a party controlled the White House for three elections.
What was your thinking in starting this? Did you have a goal, and did it change as you were working on it?
Well, my goal was trying to record history. And my goal was to, I felt, wouldn't it be interesting if you were able to speak to people who were at the beginning of a movement before people had caught up to them, not looking back, but looking forward. And I thought that that's what this could be. Beyond that, I just felt like, shoot first, ask questions later. You don't know what's going to happen in documentary. I didn't know what was going to happen. People ask me all the time, well, would you have had a movie if Hillary Clinton would have won? I always say yes. It would have been a cautionary tale, but it would have been a film. Obviously, it was, unfortunately, the film that I was scared of making, I made. But that's what it was really about for me.
I want to ask you about a couple people that you talked to. I'm going to play one clip now. This is somebody who has very strong opinions about what should be done with Hillary Clinton, who I will say now has not been charged and certainly has not been convicted of any crime. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Should be imprisoned at the least.
What's the most?
Well, if you go again, do you really want to know?
No,
do you really
want to
know?
No, don't say.
When you go against your country, what have you done? You've committed treason. How's treason punished? The death penalty.
It's easy to look at this interview and say that this guy is an outlier. Was he?
First of all, when I laugh, it's because I'm nervous. That's what was going on there. Was he an outlier? He was not an outlier to much of West Virginia and much of the South. I think he was an outlier to, he would have been an outlier to urban areas, even over urban areas that supported Trump, but he was definitely not an outlier to the rural areas. What I really think is, in today's world, when there are so many different media outlets and you have a network which is really an arm of the very most strident part of the Republican Party, which is Fox News, that people can now have their own set of facts. So it's no longer that people have their own interpretations of facts. They have their own facts. And so you have a man who can say, she is guilty of treason. And as you say, what has she been charged with? What has she been convicted of? Nothing. And yet to this man, she's already guilty of treason. And so how do you bridge that? And I think this is the single biggest pernicious aspect in America today.
That we live in a post-factual world?
Well, we live in a post-factual world, yes, but also that you have a country where you can find your own set of facts. So once you have your own set of facts, how do you bridge any conversation?
You are what everybody outside of this town would call a limousine liberal. You have a lot of money. You are a liberal Democrat. When you go into the field, it sounds like you're a cultural anthropologist, but I think in some ways you are. How many of your own preconceptions are being challenged? And even if you're meeting some people whose views are extreme and maybe not rooted in facts, did you take something away from them that challenged the way that you saw the rest of the country?
I absolutely did, particularly, I think, in a place like Arizona, where people are talking about immigration and they're walking me along the border of Mexico, and they're saying, here's where people come across the border, and they're coming over our property every night and traipsing across our lawns, and we're terrified. That's a perception that I did not have from watching television. In West Virginia, people have been out of work for 2 years. Yes, in that sense, I'm a cultural anthropologist. The one place where I really wasn't prepared to find what I found was Arizona.
But the facts are different. Apprehensions along the border are actually dramatically down for the last couple of decades. So even though people are telling you anecdotally it's worse, factually it's not. And as a person who is hearing these stories, how much of you is kind of saying, that isn't true, that isn't true? How do you challenge somebody about what they feel to be true?
Well, when a woman is saying to me that one out of every eight voters is voting fraudulently, and they're all voting for the Democrats, that you have to challenge. You have to say, where on earth are you hearing that? When a woman says that Barack Obama is going to declare martial law and cancel the election, you have to just shake your head and say, what are you talking about? So those things are more easily spoken than someone says, no, people are crossing my, you know, my fields. Now, whether that's whether illegal immigration is up or down, that's sort of beside the point to their own sense of fear.
We're talking with Jim Stern about his new movie, American Chaos. In some ways, you're the canary in the coal mine here. You are yourself part of this story. Was that always the intention? And by casting yourself as this traveler into what I will call hostile land for you, why was that decision important?
We needed a juxtaposition point to what we were hearing, and I thought that it was too dry to simply go out there and interview Hillary supporters in the same way. I wanted it to be more personal. I wanted it to be more visceral. I didn't know what I was going to find. I'd never been on camera myself in all the films that I'd done, so this was the first time. I do have a sort of personal connection. My brother was the special envoy in charge of climate change for Barack Obama, and was one of the architects, if not the architect, of the Paris Climate Change Accord. So I had that as a kind of spine to the story, and my own feelings about his work and my own feelings about where the country was going and Obama in general as a guiding force. So I felt like I was the emotional sort of pivot point for the movie, and if I did something different, it would have lost the kind of emotional, you know, aspect that I wanted to keep.
When you think about when the film is coming out, ahead of the midterm elections, we obviously know that Trump was elected president. Is there a conversation that you think this film could spark? And in some ways, are you preaching to the choir who already have a fixed opinion of people who supported Trump in the election?
You know, what's interesting to me is that the people who are more in my camp in terms of their own political persuasions, which is to say sort of at the left or side of left, I guess, have been the ones who have been more irritated at me than the people who are more to the right of me.
Irritated for what?
For letting these people speak and not to fight with them the way maybe some, you know, Michael Moore does or someone like that. And from my standpoint, the point of this film is to give them is for their own words to either hang them or not to hang them. So in terms of, you know, what do I take away from this is there's a whole swath of people who you need to have empathy for if they've been out of work or they have fear or whatever. You don't have to have sympathy for their, you know, obviously for their solutions, but you'd have to have empathy for their plight. End of the day, there's only one way to solve all this, and that's to vote. That's to vote in November.
If people looked at the raw footage that you shot, would they say that the people in the film are representative of the kinds of people you talk to, or did you select what I'll call fringe people, people who believe Hillary Clinton should be executed for treason, people who are saying things that I think it's easy to say are crazy?
I think it's an absolute cross-section of the people I talked to. I mean, yes, there have been some fringe people that I put in the movie, but there were a lot of fringe people that I talked to. There's a lot of people like Julio Martinez who says when he's talking about immigration, hey, don't you want to know who's in your house? I mean, he's completely rational. And he was the mayor of Hialeah. And Armin Grossman is very rational. And Joyce, who is the talk show host, very rational. So I think it's entirely a cross-section. In fact, it's the middle of the bullseye. I was very careful about that when I was cutting the movie.
Jim Stern is the writer, producer, director, and star of the new documentary, American Chaos. It's in theaters on September 14th. Jim, great to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And one more note for you political junkies. The Showtime series, The Circus, with John Heilman, Mark McKinnon, and Alex Wagner, returns this Sunday night. Coming up, a new show at the Getty Museum tracks the evolution of fashion photography.
KPCC KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows nine high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. A quick note about our podcast. We're going to be posting a bonus episode tomorrow. It's our preview of the Emmy Awards, which will be handed out on Monday night. In the special, which I co-host with LA Times TV critic Lorraine Ali, we have a ton of interviews with nominees, including Brian Tyree Henry of Atlanta, Carrie Brownstein from Portlandia, and Nikolai Coster-Waldau, also known as Jaime Lannister from Game of Thrones. You can get our Emmy special by subscribing to our podcast wherever you like to listen. And now, technology and social media have changed the rules for fashion photography. Digital cameras and the Instagram app took it from the hands of the elite into pretty much anyone with a smartphone. Icons of Style, A Century of Fashion Photography is a new show at the Getty, and it traces the evolution of fashion photography over the past 100 years and includes photographs by Scott Shuman. He brought digital street style photography to the masses in the early aughts with his blog, The Sartorialist. Shuman recently took the exhibit's curator, Paul Martineau, and frame contributor Mary Knopf on a walkthrough of the exhibit, where he explained his place among the fashion photography greats.
Isn't that one of the bathers, the Heunigen Hune, bather one?
Yes. Scott Shuman is a fashion photographer and founder of the blog The Sartorialist. Shuman began the blog in 2005 as a way to showcase his photography.
With the wooden box that they overturned on the rooftop.
Shuman and I are trailing behind curator Paul Martineau as he guides us through Icons of Style, an exhibit at the Getty Museum in which some of Shuman's photographs are included. As Shuman stands in front of one of his images, he talks about what attracts him to a subject.
When you see someone new, you know, it's a little bit like a crush. You know, you see them and you don't know who this person is, and they've got great style, and you're really kind of, I'm maybe figuring out who they are through taking photographs of them.
The image he's referencing, his photographic crush, as he says, is hanging on a pristine wall in the final room of the exhibit. It's a full-length profile of a woman in a snakeskin skirt, turning her head just so towards the camera.
La Beja.
A perfect example of the spontaneity Shuman's images tend to convey.
This was just one of those moments when I was, you know, kind of shooting around there, and she just happened to be standing, and maybe I called out her name so she kind of looked over her shoulder, but that happened just pretty much exactly the way that you see it. You know, I had never wanted to shoot fashion photography in kind of the traditional way, but I knew I had a good point of view in photography, and I liked people like Steve McCurry, and I liked August Sander, people who had always shot on the street. So I thought, oh, you know, there might be something here where if I went out and shot people that I thought looked interesting and looked fashionable, but that you didn't necessarily see in the magazines, there might be a blog would be an interesting place to put that.
Thanks to Instagram and social media influencers, today this type of street photography has become the default for capturing style. But when Shuman first started, photos like these were much more rare, and asking to photograph strangers, especially outside of busy fashion shows, could be a gamble. His usual approach was captured on video for the digital magazine Worldwide Amsterdam.
Excuse me, sorry. Do you mind if I just do a fast photograph? Are you just standing just like that?
What's it for?
And so the first day, you know, it didn't go so well. The first couple of people said no, and a lot of it turned out to be very intuitive. You know, the way you approach a guy is different than how you approach a girl. I really had to put myself in their place. No one in New York wants to be stopped.
So why keep doing it?
And I knew that there, you know, people shot front row, they were only kind of shooting the celebrities and the known people, and a lot of times I didn't think they looked very well dressed. There were a lot of editors in the third row or the fourth row, or people, assistants who were working backstage with the designer. Those were the people I thought, oh, they look really cool. Nobody knows who they are, but they're the actual really cool ones.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I love your fight. Sorry I didn't know who you are.
That's okay.
It's the man behind the camera.
But who are they? And why is the anonymous person on the other end of the lens so appealing? For Schumann, the answer can be found in a 1955 Richard Avedon photo hanging a few rooms over from his own collection. It's of a blonde vixen at a roulette table, casually bent over and looking to the side, as if she doesn't notice, or maybe she doesn't care, that every man in the room's gaze is on her.
You know, I grew up in Indiana, and so the world came to me through magazines and images, because Indiana didn't look like this. But this is a perfect example of the kind of photograph that I think really captures people about fashion photography. It's a life very few people lead, but it's at the same time, it's very intoxicating.
The site quickly took off. By 2011, Schumann's blog had reached 13 million monthly views. And today there's over a decade's worth of images in its archives.
Created a slant board.
Of these images, four are featured in the exhibit. And the curator, Paul Martineau, explains why he felt it important to close out the show with them.
I wanted the show to end in 2011 at the point where digital photography had become the dominant force, because it is changing how photographers do their work and how fashion photography is transmitted to the public.
Essentially, speed is everything. Again, here's Schumann.
I don't have a stylist with me. I don't have lighting with me. I'm also very much a New Yorker. I like to move quick. I don't like to spend a lot of time. I'm charming for about 5 minutes, and then that's it. I move on.
Now that social media has saturated the street photography market, it's difficult to say where the industry's headed. But after putting together the exhibit, Martineau has a few ideas.
In order to remain interesting, fashion photography always has to be changing. And it's always changing in the face of economic, political, and cultural changes in the world. And only the people who can keep up with those changes can remain on the top.
For The Frame, I'm Mary Knopf.
Icons of Style, A Century of Fashion Photography is at the Getty Museum through October 21st. And that's the show for the week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday.